Today is Sunday, February 21st, 2021. This is a Part 5 Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Jim Haggart, last name spelled H-A-G-G-A-R-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Jim. How are you today?
I'm doing great, Tom. How are you?
Real good, thank you. May we have your permission to record this oral history over the phone?
Yes, of course.
Thank you. Jim, last time you gave us a really wonderful account of what is the first recorded ascent of a named butte in Grand Canyon called Horace Temple. Just next to Horace are three other buttes, Osiris, Ra, and Set. The entire Egyptian pantheon is there, or some of the Egyptian pantheon. As you mentioned, Osiris had already been climbed, but Ra and Set hadn't. And this is 1977. Can you pick that story back up?
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. And when we climbed Horace, Scott Kronberg and I, it was kind of the start of an era for me of going after these what we considered to be pretty remote summits at the time. And we carried heavy packs, lots of two ropes typically on these climbs, and big racks because we didn't know what we were getting into, and we didn't necessarily know all the shortcut routes at that time, that we know now from hiking in the canyon for decades. So you didn't necessarily get to the base of your climb in the shortest possible time. So,
hey Jim,
yeah, these were kind of, what's that?
I'm going to step in and say, you mentioned you were carrying large racks. Now, for those people that aren't climbers, what was on your rack? What was it?
Oh, for sure, yeah. So, at that time, climbers used pitons for protection. And to use the piton, the climber who was going up first in the lead would attach the rope to his waist, and the rope, of course, would go down to his belayer, his partner, who was looking after his safety down below at a secure stance. And as the lead climber went up, he would take a piton and pound it with a hammer into a crack, and until it was secure in the crack. And the piton would have a little hole in it where you could attach a carabiner or an aluminum snap link. You put that into the hole, and then you could pass the rope that was attaching you to your belayer, your safety person down below, through that carabiner. So at that point, then you could kind of, if you fell right there, that rope would snag up tight, and you would be fairly secure just hanging there a few feet below that carabiner. So then you could climb up a higher, and if you climbed up 5 feet above that piton, and fell there, then you would fall the 5 feet down to the piton plus another 5 feet, equal to what you were above it, plus another probably 4 feet due to rope stretch. So so that was one way to mitigate the risk. Obviously, the farther you got up above your piton, the more dangerous it becomes, because you fall double that distance plus rope stretch. And
right.
So you want to put as many of these little pitons in as possible. But they're heavy. And if you don't know where the type of climb you're going to do, you don't know what kind of cracks there. Are they going to be thin cracks, a quarter inch wide, or are they going to be wide cracks, 4 or 5 inches wide? You have to carry different sizes of pitons to fit into those cracks, and so we would carry these racks of equipment. They would be slung over your shoulder, and the pitons would be kind of dangling there on a big sling, and as you needed a piton, you'd reach for it, pull it off the sling, put it in the crack, then pound it with your hammer, then put your carabiner in, and then finally clip your rope through the carabiner. That was the process. So yeah, when I was climbing with my friends there in the early to mid 70s, this was a time, a transitional time in climbing worldwide, because the era of pitons was coming to a close. And the problem with pitons is that, well, number one, they're very loud when you pound them in. So you essentially are alerting anybody in the area to your presence. That's not such a problem. But the big issue is that when you pound the piton in, it basically will distort the rock a little bit. It'll crack it, you know, here and there. And then when your second comes up behind you, the second person you're climbing with, your partner, as the leader, you get to the a rope's length above your partner, and you stop. You find a stance where you can anchor yourself, and then you take the rope up as the climber climbs. As your partner climbs up from below and to join you, and as your partner comes up, he'll remove these pitons using another hammer, right? Or sometimes you would you would lower the hammer down to save weight. You'd only carry one hammer, but in any event, the second person coming up would have to pound the piton from both sides to loosen it up, right? And by loosening it, he's actually breaking the rock, right?
Right.
And so what happens is that, where that piton was, it leaves a scar.
Oh.
And eventually, if these routes are climbed many, many times, those little tiny holes, some of the cracks that some small pitons go into are only, say, a half inch wide. And with repeated piton use there, those holes would become 2 or 3 inches wide, and it would just destroy the original fabric of the rock.
Wow.
Right?
Okay.
And climbers starting in that era didn't really like doing that, because it modified the rock and it didn't look pristine like the first persons up the route would have found it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the climbing community, essentially starting in Britain actually first, they started improvising with different equipment that could be used in place of pitons. And what the Brits did, starting in the 1960s, was they would take these big machine nuts. So think of a big nut that maybe on a railway tie or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's say 3 or 4 inches in diameter. It's got a hole in the middle, obviously, where the threads are, right?
Right.
And you would take that nut, and then you'd put a sling on it, a nylon loop, through the hole in the middle of the nut. And you could take that nut, then, and you could wedge it in a crack, right? You could kind of find a place where the crack was, tapering downward, and you could slide this big nut into the crack where it would fit, and then pull it down a little bit, and it would wedge up against the taper of the crack,
mm-hmm.
and then you could attach your rope and carabiner to that loop that was on the nut. And so, this became initially a supplement for pitons.
Okay.
So that people when they were in a rush, for instance, and they needed to move fast, they could put a nut in if instead of a piton, and because they're a lot easier to take out too.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. You just lift them up, and they, if they haven't wedged in there somehow, they can be easily extracted. So these informal pieces of equipment, because they were actually machine nuts, became to be called nuts in the climbing community. And starting around 1970, there were a number of mountaineering and climbing manufacturing firms, mostly small firms like Yvon Chouinard at Great Pacific Iron Works, and Bill Dolt, and other climbers who started manufacturing nuts, they called them, which were essentially wedges of aluminum of different shapes. And these wedges would, some of them, have a metal loop of cord, metal cord, that goes,
mm-hmm.
went through them. Or they would just have a series of holes drilled through them, and you could attach your own nylon loop to these wedges. And so in place of the piton, then you could use one of these wedges, and you would take it off your rack, your climbing rack, just as you would the piton, and then you would find a crack that was suitably shaped, and you'd wedge the chalk stone or nut into the climbing wedge into the crack, and then attach your rope to it. Right, with it's the same principle. Once you get the piece of protection inserted into the crack.
So were you carrying both pitons and nuts and that both sets then?
Yes, we were. We would do that because as I mentioned, you know, where you find good nut placements, in other words, if there's a place in a crack that is really nicely designed to take a nut, it tapers really, you know, dramatically and clearly, and you could put the nut in there and it's just perfectly wedged, you know, you would use that because it was preferable. It was just faster to put it in there, right?
Yeah.
And but you couldn't always count on finding these perfect placements, we would call them. And in some cases, the crack would be parallel-sided, right?
Right.
Particularly on granite rocks, not so much on the desert sandstones and whatnot, but on some rock types, the cracks will be parallel-sided, and, you know, you can't put a nut in there so that it wedges in. So you need to have a piton in an instance like that. So we would carry both types of equipment. And and in the early days, they didn't have, you know, a wide variety of sizes for these wedges, these aluminum wedges, the nuts, chalk stones, artificial chalk stones, we call them. And so you had to have both, at least initially. But as time went by in the 1970s, the pitons really fell out of disfavor, and virtually nobody climbs with pitons to any great extent these days, right? Hmm. There's still places where they have their purpose, and people will use them, particularly in extreme mountaineering type of settings, you know. Mm-hmm. But with sport climbing all the rage these days, and with all the new engineering that's gone into the design of this equipment, you really don't need pitons anymore. There's plenty of these lightweight aluminum chalk stones or camming devices, which is another type of equipment that was invented in the 80s.
Yeah, weren't around in 77. Okay, so you've got a rack that's got pitons and chalks on it, and you got a hammer, and you got a lot of that stuff. So then let's get back to Ron's set.
Yeah, right. So anyways, I really wanted to climb Raw because it was it really stood out, right? Mm. You know, from Hermit's Rest, you look across there, and Raw actually had a very interesting history. I don't know if you know about the Stanton trip down the river that you know, they attempted to climb Raw, and
that was 1889, 1890.
Right, And it wasn't clear that Stanton had got to the top of Raw. It did sound like he hadn't, but it was an epic climb nonetheless, and through the Red Wall. And so I didn't actually know about the details of Stanton's route at that point.
Okay.
But Harvey Butchert had mentioned this in his Trex book. And anyways, this was just a very obvious summit that was standing out there that I knew no one had climbed, right?
Okay.
That there was no record of it that I could come across. And so, you know, I was thinking about this. Scott and I climbed Horus in the winter of 77, 78, I guess it was. It was actually 77 January, right? 76, 77 is when we climbed Horus. So, I just got really gassed to try and do the first ascents of Raw and Set as well, right?
Okay.
And so I talked with my friends Art Christensen and Barbara Zinn. Barbara Zinn, I think, was going to NAU at that time, and she actually knew Harvey. She took some math classes with him.
Okay.
And then my friend Art was he worked at Desert Mountain Sports. And we had hiked together in the Grand Canyon previously.
How do you spell their last names?
Christensen is Christensen. And
Barbara?
Barbara Zinn. Zinn.
Thank you. Had you
So,
climbed with them before?
oh yeah. Not so much Art, because he didn't consider himself a climber, although he's extremely competent
Okay.
as a climber. But I had climbed a lot with Barbara
Okay.
in high school, because we went to the same high school
Oh.
in Phoenix,
Okay.
in Scottsdale, and so she was a year behind,
Okay.
and she knew my friend Chris. They were girlfriend and boyfriend at the time,
Okay.
and so Barbara and I climbed together for for about 2 years, on and off in the Phoenix area. So we had climbed together, and I had done some short things with Art, but mostly hikes. But I knew that Art was a very competent scrambler. And anyways, we decided we were going to go to Escalante Canyon up in Utah and do a backpack.
Okay.
And we were going to go, and we didn't know too much about the scene, the scenery there at the time, like all the hot spots. I guess they just weren't, the information wasn't that widely distributed. So anyways, we decided we were going to just hike the whole length of the canyon, and we put in at where the paved road crosses Escalante River.
Okay.
And then the plan was to hike all the way down as close, as close to the Lake Powell as we could get.
Wow, that's a
And
long. I mean that I'm just going to say, wait a minute. That Escalante goes around and round and round. It's like not a straight canyon. It zigzags. It's one of the
oh
snakiest
yeah,
rivers I know.
this was like a 7 or 8 day trip that we planned.
Okay.
It might have been even 10. I can't remember exactly. I probably have some notes hidden away on this at some point,
Okay.
someplace. But it was an extended trip, and I remember one part of it. I walked for 3 days barefoot. I mean, that's
Wow.
how long a hike it was. And of course, when you get down deeper into Escalante Canyon, there's a lot of rock fall in places, and it's challenging. You can't go barefoot in there, but there were long stretches up higher where it's just sand and fine gravel along the sides of the river, and I walked for 3 days barefoot. So I know that it was an extended trip because that was only a small part of it, but it was such a gorgeous experience that I was able to do that. In any event, I don't want to get too distracted on Southern Utah, but
Yes.
I had told Art and Barb. I said, "Why don't we just put some climbing gear in the car, right? So that when we finish our hike down Escalante, we got options if we want to do something else." And I can't remember if I was at an ulterior motive here at the start of the hike or what, but I do remember that we had planned on the option to do some climbing afterwards. And so we eventually finished the Escalante trip, spectacular, as you know. And when we got to the down at the bottom end, we start running into all sorts of people, big groups of people, and because they'd hiked down from what is it? Is it Davis? Oh, I can't remember the access points now, but there's a very common, popular way to access the lower Escalante, and it shaves a lot of time off your 9 day trip down the whole length of the canyon. But
Right. Well, you've got to
we
get out
finished our trip.
through the reservoir as well. If you keep going down the drains, you walk right into water. So you got to deal with that.
We went down a ways, and then we started encountering like high water muck, and we just said, "This is enough. We don't need to keep going." So then we backtracked up a little bit, and that was where Coyote Gulch. Does that sound familiar? Is that the one of the access points? I know there's a Coyote Gulch in Kanab
Yeah,
too.
it may be.
Not Kanab, but what's? Oh
Cody
my goodness,
Buttes,
what's?
the Cody Buttes, maybe Wire Pass area, or no, you may be thinking of a different one.
Yeah, anyways, it's not relevant. It's not the Grand Canyon, so anyways, after we finished that trip, then I said, what do you guys think about trying raw,
Okay.
and they bought into it right away. It was great. It
All
was
right.
no problem then. So we drove down to the North Rim, and took the car. I don't remember whose car we had. Probably Art's, but in any event, we were able to drive out Teal Point,
Okay.
and nowadays, that's all wilderness area, I think, and you can't drive past the basin,
Right, the road is
which is,
closed. The
yeah, that's
Teal Point
right.
Road. And that's spelled TIYO.
That's right. That's
Okay.
right. But at the time, you could drive down, I think all the way to Teal Point,
Okay.
and so we just drove part way because we needed to get to an access point that was a mile or two west of Teal Point.
Okay.
And so we left the car on the road and then walked through the forest, found the access point, which goes down to Shiva Temple, and then worked our way down from the Supai Saddle there down through the Red Wall into Dragon Creek,
Okay.
and walked down Dragon Creek to basically where it joins Crystal. And there's good flow there, good water. So, we had a great campsite there. And we knew about this access from Harvey Butchard's Trex volume, right?
Okay.
So this was nothing new. This was an established Butchard route. Although I don't think neither of the three of us had been down this route before. So anyways, we got to our camp in Crystal, and I had a great experience a couple of years ago because I gave a talk about this climb to the Granitico Symposium in Flagstaff,
Right.
Granitica Symposium on Grand Canyon climbing, and I wanted to bring in my colleagues on the climb, Art and Barb, and I asked them for ideas and suggestions, and Barb said, "Well, don't forget the barking frogs," and I said, "What was that?" And she said, "Don't you remember?" She said, "You woke up in the middle of the night screaming because you thought there were barking frogs, and there were frogs around in this campsite." But
Oh my gosh.
I it was just they're very. I guess they were very loud, and I, kind of interpreted them sinisterly, and it kind of woke me up out of a sound sleep, and I thought it was some sort of a nightmare. Anyways, we all had a good laugh about that. So that apparently happened at that campsite.
Okay.
Anyways, if the next morning, of course, we're getting ready to go up to Ra, and we didn't have any idea about the route possibilities. We just thought we'd go. Now, Harvey and Alan Doty had been up. No, sorry, I think it was Donald Davis had been up through the Red Wall in the arm north that's directly north of Ra,
Right.
and between that comes down from the Supai Saddle between Ra and Osiris.
Right.
And have you been up that
Yes.
or down it?
Yes.
Yeah. And so we knew about that route from Grand Canyon Treks,
Okay.
and so we started up, and it was actually a little bit harder to get through the Red Wall than we
Yeah,
figured it would be because
it's a little,
Harvey and
yeah.
yeah, it's just a little dicey there, but we got up there and then we continued up, and it was it was a fairly uneventful climb. It was there was a pitch in the mid supai, just a short pitch, maybe 12 or 15 feet to get through that interval, and then this would have been on the East Ridge, the East Supai Ridge. It's mostly just slogging up the shale slopes, right,
Right.
with the periodic sandstone here and there. And then we got to the summit block, and we walked around it, looking for what we thought was the easiest route. And we settled on a route on the east side, which was a series of chimneys.
Okay.
And my recollection is it was two pitches. Nothing really challenging, not too difficult. We rated it 5-6 at the time, and we would have put in some protection. I don't remember using any pitons on that climb, but it certainly would have taken some nuts. And it was just a very moderate, straightforward climb. The three of us just were having a great time because we were super fit after being down in Escalante for 10 days. And, it was just one of these perfect experiences, except it took us longer than we expected.
Yeah.
So I should have known after our Horus thing that these climbs can can sometimes take a lot, you know, more time than you anticipate. So eventually we decided, okay, we gotta head down and back to camp. And so we started down, and we didn't want to do that down climb through the red wall.
Oh.
And we thought, you know, it's going to be a snotty rappel because of it was very broken, a limestone cliff, and would just be easier, we thought, to just rappel off the red wall drop right in the bed of the drainage that comes down between Set and Osiris. So we walked down that drainage, got right to the lip, and Art set two bolts there for a rappel. And so we had a bolt kit with us too, right? There's another piece of equipment you would carry in the Grand Canyon,
which is a hammer and a pretty heavy drill, drill steel or two, and then a bunch
of you'd have a replacement
bolts
bit for sure.
Yeah, to set with a setting tool. It's a lot of stuff.
It's a lot of stuff, and you know, and then you have your hanger, which would go on the bolt. You would and then you could clip your nylon runners to the two hangers that were on the two bolts, and then make a contraption that your rope could go through. And so we had two ropes with us, right? So we knew that, you know, we had 150 feet of free fall that we could deal with. So we put the ropes together, we tie them together, and put them in the anchor and in the rappel anchor, and we throw the ropes over, and then I hook the two ropes into my diaper sling around my waist, and I back over to the edge, and I back over the edge, and I look down, and the rope is hanging free, all the way down, it's free, and I can see that it is just dangling free in space.
Oh my God!
You know, and I couldn't tell exactly how far it was down to the actual ground beneath it, but probably at least 20, 25 feet,
oops,
you know? And yeah, so there was no way that we could do this, you know, without two longer ropes. So after spending all that time, Art probably spent like an hour or more setting those two bolts,
yeah,
you know? It was getting pretty late in the day,
gosh.
So we figured, well, we can't get back to our camp now, so we bivouacked in the saddle there between Ra and Osiris.
Oh wow!
It was May, right? It was May of 77, so the temperatures were a little on the warm side. It was quite pleasant, and we had a fun night there. I don't recall any fires at that point. I mentioned that I had a fire on Horus.
Yeah,
but that was for warmth. And by May we were taking this dictate about no fires in the Grand Canyon pretty seriously. So, you know, we didn't need a fire and we didn't make one at that time. But we spent the night up there and as best we could, you know. And then in the morning, as tired as we were, we figured, well, we're up here. Let's try and climb Osiris, you know. And we knew that had been done by Don Davis with Harvey.
Mm-hmm.
Not with Harvey, but Harvey had stayed behind while Donald went up and did the climb himself. Also, you probably know about the pot that Harvey and Davis found up in the red wall. They found an Aboriginal pot, a whole pot in a cave in the red wall there. And
I don't know about
they
that.
They made
one.
A note of it, and the park ranger. What's that? Go ahead.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, well, that I think it's mentioned in Harvey's book, but if not there, it's certainly in the notes that he had on his trip, right, about his trip.
Huh.
So we're looking all around trying to find the cave where this pot might have been found, and we didn't see anything, but you know, it's not that we would have liked to have seen it if it was still there. It might not have been there. The rangers may have retrieved it by that time.
Hmm.
Anyways, we got up Osiris that morning, and that's another climb that, you know, it requires some scrambling. You've probably done that one.
Sure.
You've been up in that area. And but no rope work.
Right.
And so we got up that and had a fantastic view up there. And you know, this was really satisfying because we just knocked off two summits, right? And one of them being a first ascent. And we really only expected to get one. We were really only focused on Ra, and we managed to get Osiris too, right? So it was a really, really satisfying trip. And we eventually worked our way back down to the camp, and I don't remember the details after that, but we went back out the same way we came in, and then had a fairly uneventful return to Phoenix, I think. So, but it was like it was kind of like a, this period was like a catalyst. It really started firing me up to go after these things. And when you have a two successes in a row like that, you just start to think everything's going to fall into place for you. So
Well,
I've noticed I've
it's funny now because I was thinking, all right, well, what's left of those four is Set. You've already walked right past Set to get to Horus.
That's
So
right.
you're like, oh, I know how to do that.
Yeah, that's right. And so that fall, I think it would have been I think in October of 77. Yeah, that's what my note says here. Yeah, so I was talking to Bruce Grubbs, who lives in Phoenix, another person you probably will chat with eventually if you haven't already. Bruce ran the Mountaineer climbing hut in climbing shop in Phoenix, and they specialized in hiking and climbing and backpacking and skiing. And so Bruce was a good friend of mine. I'd climbed with him a lot in Phoenix when we were both in the Arizona Mountaineering Club, and we'd already done some hiking together. But I said, "Why?" I suggested to him, "Let's try Tower of Set." And by this time, I had scoped out this route down to the river and up the other side, so I thought, well, at least that's quicker than having to come in from Phantom Ranch. And so we knew we could get up the Red Wall there if we had to. Well, we knew we could get up the chute, right? Because of the when we'd found the Surveyor's Trail, it would be a straight shot to go down the Hermit Trail, float across the river, and then head up to the Red Wall. The thing is, we'd never done any floating in the river at that point. So,
And neither,
yeah, it was
well,
a little.
Harvey had. He'd done a lot of his air mattress swimming, and a couple other people had done. Eber Glenn Denning was doing crossing the river in a little pack raft at the time, or before then, actually. So how did you approach? How are we going to get across the river? Who had the beta, and what equipment did you use?
Yeah. Well, this was it was you kind, it was very seat of the pants. Okay, so from the beta, I guess you could say that I had scoped it out, right? So I knew the route would go at least, it looked like it would go all the way up through the Tapetes on the other side. It looked pretty straightforward. And then, so as far as the equipment goes, we didn't. This was back before. Nowadays, you can get pack rafts that are really nicely constructed nylon things, that are very lightweight. And Bruce had a he like had like a small, I think it's called a Tahiti inflatable kayak type boat. It was probably about, I don't know, 10 pounds or something like that.
Or a little
And I
more.
just went, what's
Yeah,
that?
or a little more.
Yeah, it might not have been a Tahiti, but it was some sort of an inflatable, not a full, enclosed kayak or anything like that. But it was a little bit bigger than your standard pool raft, which is what I went out and got.
A little
And
Sevlar pool toy kind of thing.
it wasn't even Kevlar. It was just
I mean
vinyl plastic.
Sevlar's a brand. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Anyways. Bruce had a little bit more rugged boat, not
Okay.
that great, and then I had this pool toy.
Okay.
And I actually remember I living in Phoenix, that summer I actually got in our family pool a number of times with my backpack, fully loaded with all the climbing gear and everything. And then I would, gingerly get into the raft, and I had a little paddle. And then I would paddle around in the pool just to get, familiar with at least the in getting in and out of it, because it was very very precarious. But so we decided that we were going to try this climb by just taking this route and floating the river. And of course, we knew, as you pointed out, that Harvey floated the river, and it was kind of like just something we had to do, to
Did you think you needed
accessing more?
Did you think you needed a life jacket?
We did not have life jackets.
Okay.
We did not carry them, and it was. I'm not sure. I don't think we debated it.
Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't. It just never crossed our minds.
Right.
And
okay.
It's not like at that point, life jackets were kind of like, K-POC life preservers, or jackets that you wear. I mean, there was no sophisticated design, at least that we were aware of.
Right. They were large.
And
they
no,
were heavy.
We did not. We did not carry anything like that. I guess, when you're that age, you just assume that you're going to either make it or you're going to swim out of the river,
right.
Right. Which was pretty unrealistic. I certainly wouldn't approach it that way now, right? So, but anyways, we organized the trip, the two of us, and we went down there, and it all worked out smoothly. We crossed the river, no problem. And
so did you hike down to Hermit Rapid and then hike up the river to 90? It's between Granite and Hermit. I forget. I think 94. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, what we did was we went down the Hermit.
Right.
And when you get to the Tonto, you turn right.
Okay.
And you go up a little saddle in the Bright Angel Shale.
Right.
And then you start walking around into Monument Creek.
Right.
And right when you pass that saddle in the shale, there's a fault.
Right.
Ravine that goes down north of Cope Butte.
Right.
And so you can work your way down that fault ravine and then get below the Tapeach and go straight down to the river. And then the fault actually continues across the river and cuts the Tapeach on the north side as well.
Right.
And it actually is the fault actually continues up to the northeast and then also cuts the Red Wall, which forms that break, right? Just below Set. So
now where that
it's a very
fault
nice
ravine, where that fault ravine puts you at the river is a little rapid right there.
Yes, and so we walked that's right across the mouth from the mouth of 94 Mile
Creek.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we walked upstream about a quarter mile, something like that,
okay.
On the south side.
Okay.
And I had hiked this actually before from Granite Rapids at the mouth of Monument down to Hermit Creek.
Oh.
I'd hiked that stretch of the river, just as a hike before that. So it was not like it was anything unknown. We knew we could hike upstream as far as we needed to. So,
okay.
Yeah, we hiked up a quarter mile above the rapids and, just put our boats together and then went across. And we had two boats just in case one of them happened, something happened to one of them, right?
Right.
And so, obviously, once we got to the north side of the river, we didn't need the boats anymore, so we didn't take them up on the climb. We just stashed them at the river for our return a day or two later. And so we continued up and got to the surveyor's camp on top of the Red Wall.
Okay.
And I believe that was where we camped.
So,
and I remember
so hang
I
on.
Just had,
let me just make sure I get this right. Your first day was down the Hermit, down the 94 fault route, cross the river, up to the Tapeach and up to the Red Wall. That was your first day.
That's right. So on top of the Red
Wow.
Wall there.
That's an aggressive day. I mean, that just gives me a vision of how strong you guys were at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't think of it that way, but we were in good shape. There's no question. You got 22-year-old guys, right? They're pretty fit, especially when you're focused on this kind of so much of your life, right?
Mm, yeah.
You can handle this stuff pretty straightforward. And plus, I knew I didn't want to have another one of these overnights, right? One of these bivouacs. So, I was motivated, right?
And there's no water up there.
There's no water, so we had to carry our water up from the river.
Right.
Right? Yeah, and we were figuring that we would be, that Set would be from a camp at, on top of the Red Wall, because we knew the way that Scott Kronberg and I had gotten up through the Supai, you know, earlier in the year. We knew that route would go, and it was just a question of slogging around and doing that, those short climbs, and then we go up to Sed itself, and so we figured that it would be very straightforward to get back to our camp at least in the one day of climbing, and probably farther down, you know, back to the river at least. And right. So, you know, the climbing was pretty uneventful. Sed is a really easy climb. So, you know, we followed the route that Scott and I had pioneered, 6 months before, 10 months before, I guess.
Right.
And then climbed Sed, and again found no evidence on top of prior ascents. So mm-hmm. we basically ticked off first recorded ascent.
Well, you mentioned the surveyor, Washburn,
mm-hmm.
and
Bradford Washburn.
Right, right. On the top of Sed, there should have been a little aluminum rod up there.
Yeah, see, I don't remember that. There was one on Ra.
Okay.
I didn't mention that when I told you about the Ra experience. There was a lot of debris on top of Ra.
Right.
And there very well may have been on top of Sed. I just don't have any right. recollection of it.
It was on both, so yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It makes sense, because he probably touched base on every –
Yep.
On every summit, right?
That's right.
Yeah, that he could land on anyway.
That's right.
Yeah, and it may have been that by this time, you know, after Horace and after Ra, we were kind of resigned to encountering these things,
mm-hmm.
you know, this detritus.
Right.
And so it just didn't register too much on me. So one of the neat things about that trip, like the climb itself was pretty incidental, but I remember I was sitting on top of the Red Wall there in my sleeping bag with Bruce, and we were chatting, and I had just gotten 4 wisdom teeth extracted,
ooh.
like a week before, you know, sometime before, and I remember I had to you know, the water is kind of precious, but I had to use a certain amount of it to flush out these sockets in my jaw, you know, and I had this little syringe. And I was just sitting there in my sleeping bag and you know, looking at the view and then doing my hygiene right with my teeth. It was kind of funny recollection. But one of the things we did get to do up there is Bruce and I spent a fair amount of time poking around in the debris from the surveyor's camp, you know. And so we got pretty excited about what was going on with that. And Bruce subsequently did some research on this and started going into the archives at the university, and he quickly found out that Harvey kind of knew all about this, this surveyor's tramway. It just hadn't been written up yet, right? And so, you know, he got information from Harvey about the original effort, and he sent that to me by mail. You know, this is back when you had to send letters,
mm-hmm.
Written letters, and so Bruce sent me a letter by mail, I guess down to Tucson probably, and said, you know, he'd done research on this and found out that it was for a tramway, right, that was going to be running from the south rim up to the north rim, and,
right.
And these guys had been surveying this. It was pretty neat stuff, you know, and of course, we didn't have any idea that you know, before Scott and I had been up there earlier in the year, we didn't have any idea there was any sort of a trail there. So to get all this detailed information about it was pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was Sed. So that gave me 3.
Hang on a second.
All 4 of those summits, but three first ascent.
So hang on a second. So you camped on top of the Red Wall.
Yes.
Summit had set. Did you go back and spend the second night at the top of the Red Wall and then retreat?
No,
from
my
there?
Recollection is we summited Sed, we came down, we poked around looking through the surveyor's trash and gear,
right.
And then we put our packs on and went back down to the river.
Okay.
We went to the river because we had a water source there, right?
Got it.
So, you know, I don't remember whether we crossed the river that day or the next morning. My recollection is that it was the next morning. We got to the river and just relaxed on the North Shore. So,
right. Then, okay, so that's summit number 4, first ascent documented number 3.
Yeah, that's right. It was pretty exciting, and at that point, I found that Bruce and I really clicked as a team,
Huh.
and I'm not necessarily any more than anybody else I hiked with, right?
Yep.
But just that we had similar objectives and similar capabilities and similar knowledge and things like that. And he's such an interesting guy. I mean, he's an engineer by nature and does a lot of flying of small planes, and
Okay.
so lots of great stories to talk about and share over at when you're getting ready for bed. And so we thought we were going to do more hikes, climbs in the future. And so I went back down to U of A, and I at one point I either called him on the phone or I sent him a letter, probably the former, and said, I'm getting the bug, Bruce, for another trip. How about we go in to the Eastern Grand Canyon? And so my proposal was to do a multi-day trip and multi-summit trip to go after Temple Butte, Char Butte, and Ahwatubee,
Okay.
and maybe Quaggan if we had time, right? So you know the lay of the land there. If you go down the Tanner Trail and you float across the river, you can get into the Horse Thief Butte Fault drainage system, and use that geographic feature to access a lot of this country fairly directly.
Right.
And he thought, Bruce thought it was a great idea, right? Because we knew this was going to be a longer trip. This was not, your typical three-day trip to do Tower of Set.
Right.
This was going to be a longer trip because it was a lot bigger area to cover. And
Right.
so we decided to do that in January
Okay.
of 78.
Okay.
So another Christmas time trip, right after the holidays.
Well, which is smart
And
because you won't bake your brains out, and you don't have to worry so much about water, which is a concern on the Butte Fault.
that's right. And as it turns out, it was a minor concern, and we had some interesting developments along that line at one point, which I'll get to.
Okay.
God, I don't remember, the details of planning this trip or anything, but we went down the Tanner Trail and then walked up to Lava Canyon Rapids, where Palisades Creek comes down
Right.
from the east,
Up
and then
the
walked about another mile, I guess, up river to just above the mouth of Carbon Creek, which comes down from the west,
Okay.
and that's where we crossed with our little boats,
Did Bruce look at your little pool toy and go, your pool toy weighs less than my Tahiti. Did he change craft or did he slug that Tahiti down there?
No, I said it was a Tahiti, and it was some sort of an inflatable boat, but it was better than mine, but it was not, it was maximum probably 10 pounds. So I
Okay.
don't remember what kind of boat it was, but I think Bruce was more rational, and he said, I don't mind carrying the extra weight if it gives me a bigger margin of security,
Right,
right?
right. So a little more sturdy
So.
boat. Yeah.
Yeah, and my thinking at the time was probably if I had the money, I'd probably go get one of these boats that Bruce has because I can see the definite advantage, if something happens to your boat, right? And
Yeah.
so yeah, so we're kind of, both of us are in that position, right? It's like I didn't have a lot of money going to school, and you had to allocate your funds to your priorities, and mine was ropes, right?
Right.
So yeah, so we basically had the same gear, and for this trip as well, and we knew it worked, right? So that was the critical thing.
Right.
So
And again, same bringing two ropes and full racks. And big packs and all this junk, all the way down the Tanner and then up toward the Beamer to above Carbon. Was that like day one for you guys? Or did you actually cross that
I
day?
think we crossed because I
Okay.
recall walking up Carbon in the fading light of
Okay.
the evening, right?
Okay.
And be all gloomy shadows, with
Yeah.
those uplifted tapetes strata there, and so that was my recollection. Is we got that far and camped, probably up in the open valley, above the Tapeach there. I have a very, very sharp recollection of camping there. So, and we would have schlepped water up there. I don't think there's water at I can't recall now whether there's water at that campsite, but you're so close to the river there that it was no big deal, right? So the next day then the plan was to do temple, and we headed up and up the Butte Fault there, up the drainages, and to the north of Temple Butte, and I think Temple's one you've done too now. So and if you go to the north of the summit, on the west side, you can work your way up through the Red Wall. And I just remember the Red Wall being a little tricky, you know, nothing really serious, not rope work, nothing like that, but just, you had to be careful and pick your way and find a route and a little bit of exposure. That's the way I remember it.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah. And then we got to the top of the Red Wall there, and you can, easily walk the Supai slopes to the south and east to get up between the two summits of Temple.
Right.
And they're not very high summits, the one on the south end is it's my recollection is it's like a 25-foot block of sandstone forms the summit of the south end. And that's the higher end of the two, I believe.
That's right.
And then the north end is more broken and just a series of Supai steps, right?
Right.
That one walks to the top. But the southern summit, we actually roped up for that. And I remember putting a little nut in it to a little crack because there was a kind of a step across, and then you had to step across an open gap, right? From one block to the main summit block. And then you had to, make a somewhat delicate move up to gain the summit block itself. And so we were able to protect that with a nut, and it was a fairly simple climb, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think people probably do it without rope now. But, again, it was for us, it was a big deal, right?
Yeah.
And we were pretty jazzed about that. And then I remember walking across. So we went and climbed the south summit first, and then we were going to go walk up the north summit. And there's the ridge, the open ridge between the two. And, we're moving along because we're so fit. We're moving along really fast there and with our climbing gear around our shoulders and whatnot and day packs on. And we're like halfway across that traverse, and I just took a header and went flying forward. Just amazing. It's incredible that nothing was broken or hurt, no chipped teeth or nothing, right?
Wow.
It was fine. It was just one of these experiences where just all of a sudden went flying,
Wow.
And I was at this time I was still wearing like heavy duty hiking boots and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
The lightweight hiking shoes hadn't really been
invented yet.
Been invented. And so we had this heavy-duty footwear on, and it was really easy to trip on that kind of, when you're moving fast. Anyways, whatever the reason, I just took this spill, and the reason I think about that spill is because it seems like more or less every long trip I've taken since then, somebody has taken a spill of one sort or another, right?
Hmm.
That is just never been serious. Nobody's ever gotten, really a major hurt, maybe some cuts, maybe some bruises. But it seems like it's a fairly common phenomenon on the hikes that I take, myself and with other people.
I've done it a number of times, sure.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess we just can chalk the fact that we are, careful and reasonably careful and aware of our environment, to the point that we subconsciously kind of have an idea of how to deal with a fall when it happens, right? It's not something that You instantaneously, as you start to trip, think, oh, I have to do this, I have to do that. It's just like you subconsciously react in the manner that you need to buttress yourself on the, against the fall. At least this is my theory, and it basically gets me off the hook, right?
Well, young strong people that fall are called stuntmen, you know.
There you go.
So we're pretty durable. It's just as we get older, then we start breaking things. But yeah.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it does come as a surprise. It's like, holy cow! I just fell flat on my face here. I got to get up.
Oh yeah,
that
yeah.
Happened?
And it's over in a second, and yeah. And you're looking up at staring at the sky and wondering what happened, you know. So but anyways, we got up the North Summit and then retreated, and we had a camp down in the Carbon Creek drainage there, just below Temple Butte. So we had a dry camp there.
Okay.
And so the next day, you know, our objective was to go for at least Char Butte and Ahwatubi Crest on the trip, right?
Okay.
So we and possibly Quaggan. So we started slogging north and went up onto the ridges west of Ahwatubi and got to where we could scope out Quaggan, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we would have had binoculars. Maybe we even went down into Ahwatubi Creek.
So
drainage.
did you figure you would do Chuar on the way back and you wanted to like go way north or?
Yeah, no, the objective, the plan was to go north, and because we wanted to do Quaggan too, right? If we could.
Okay.
And so the idea was that we could potentially go north, get Quaggan, the biggest one, first, and then come back south, get Ahwatubi, and then continue south, you know, back
to
Char, and then down south. We just happened to do Temple Butte. I don't know why we did that first as opposed to going north.
Whetting your
Quaggan,
appetite.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, that, something like that. But but when we got down to Ahwatubi Crest, or maybe down into the drainage, I don't know, looking up at Quaggan, we realized that this was a bigger objective than we had thought it might be. You know, Quaggan's a pretty major climb and a major objective. So we figured we didn't have the gear for it. I don't think we had. We did have a bolt kit. I know we did for sure. So and I think we looked up at the climbing. And it just looked, you know, really hard. And so we felt like we needed to come back with a bigger, stronger party to tackle that. So we turned around, and then, and this is when we were starting to, you know, this issue of water was starting to rear its ugly head because even though it was January and it was cool, it was still sunny, and we were doing a lot of activity, and we didn't have, you know, there wasn't a lot of ready water down there. There's none in 60 Mile. So we're still carrying the water from the river, right? Mm. So we were starting to get thirsty because we didn't know where there might be any water in the vicinity. So we climbed up Ahwatubi, and the neatest part about Ahwatubi is a simple little climb. It's just a scramble, right? But the neat thing is that the geology there, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if you've done that, but you know the rocks are because of the location of the butte fault there, the rocks have been upended vertically.
Right.
So the Supai and the Red Wall and the Tapeach are all sticking up vertically, and so you get all these pinnacles and weirdly eroded ridges and whatnot. And Ahwatubi is basically the crest of one of these pinnacles that's sticking vertically up. And it's easy to hike up to it and scramble up to the top, but it's just really interesting geologically. And by this time, I had entered the geology program.
Oh, interesting!
At the University of Arizona.
Okay.
So I was really, I was really tuning into this stuff. You know, this was just so cool to see the evidence of this faulting, you know, on such prominent display. You know, and but anyways, we get to the top of Ahwatubi, and it was late in the afternoon. Now, of course, in January, that's like 4 o'clock, right?
Right.
And So the sun was kind of going down behind us, right, as we're looking east towards the Palisades of the desert. And we look down, and so what happens is you're on top of Awatubi and you're on the supai that's sticking up vertically. And then, of course, below your feet, the rocks go down, and then the supai flattens out and then forms these big terraces to the east of the crest, Awatubi Crest. So a big flat terrace of supai sandstone there. And we're looking down on this terrace, and all of a sudden we start seeing all these jewels sparkling,
Oh,
you
cool.
know. And it was rain pockets,
Yeah.
right? Water pockets that were illuminated by the sun and the close to setting sun. And it was just such a neat experience to see all that and to know we had water right at hand, you
Right,
know. So
right.
we were able to run down there and fill up all of the containers we had, and so we had a pretty nice camp that night in 60 Mile. And actually well, that's the next day after our climb, but so that set us up really well for our climb up Char Butte, right?
Okay.
And so we had a camp in 60 Mile. It was on the red wall, on top of on the red wall rim, overlooking the main part of the drainage. And because we knew we were going to go from there up pretty much straight up to Supai to get to the base of the climbing on Char.
Okay.
And again, it was, you know, we had a great night, got up in the morning, I think, and it was starting to get overcast. Char was, the weather was definitely overcast and a lot colder that day.
Okay.
And so we worked our way up. The climbing is very simple, straightforward, all the way up through the Supai and the Coconino until you get into the final chutes near the top, and then it gets a little bit more dicey. It's still third classable, but we actually did a roped pitch in as the our final, you know, summit pitch to get to the top.
Okay.
And I remember putting a piece of protection in there, but I don't recall what size it was. But then got to the top, and by this time there were flurries, right? It was
Ooh.
Blowing flurries on top. And it was pretty chilly, but we definitely went over to the high point to make sure there was no cairn there,
Right.
and then we actually walked around the summit block itself, or it's a pretty expansive
Yeah.
mesa, really,
Yeah.
on top, and walked all around there and looking for cairns or anything, and they know that might signal that somebody else had been up there before, and couldn't find anything, So then started down. We actually rappelled. I remember that we rappelled the upper chimney gully there, and I guess just to be safe. And then worked our way back down to the camp. And we actually had these nice tarps that we'd set up as A-frames, right?
Oh.
You'd use your walking stick, and because I would carry a staff, and Bruce carried a ski pole. For a walking stick, and then you'd get a, you know, like a piece of agave or something, and make a tent pole for the other end, and then you can make a nice A-frame
Okay.
and you know, camp under that. And that night it just poured,
Ooh.
right? This so some winter storm came through,
Right.
and it just poured and really came down. So we were fortunate that we had that shelter, you
Yeah.
know, because a lot of these trips we don't take anything, anticipating that we're going to find ledges and whatnot. So this time we didn't have any ledges on top of the red wall, and we needed that shelter. So yeah, so you know, that was the end of the climbing on that trip. We tried to get down 60 Mile. I remember that we poked around in the red wall, trying to find a route down in 60 Mile, and we were unsuccessful. I understand. You probably know if there's a route up.
There is a route, but I would never be able to find it from the top. I only found it from the bottom.
Okay.
It's this amazing. You walk off at the top, right next to this waterfall. You come up over this round crest of red wall. There's no way I'd ever put my nose over there expecting to find a route. I wouldn't even gone there. So
Oh yeah.
yeah, so it's just
So is that more or less in the drainage?
it's way down by the mouth.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because that's where we were focusing our efforts too, way down closer to the mouth on the south side,
That's where it is. That's exactly where it is. Yep,
okay.
you were close.
Well, anyways, yeah.
Yeah.
I think if we had found a way down there, we probably would have taken our packs down
Oh.
and gone down the river that way, you
And
know.
boated back home. What a good idea.
Yeah,
Yeah.
that would have been fun. Actually, we had left the boats at
Oh,
Lava. I mean,
at Carbon.
Carbon Creek rather.
Okay.
Yeah, so. But we could have come down the route on the east side there, coming down below underneath Temple and whatnot. Anyways, that was the plan, but we couldn't find the route, so we from above, so we reversed our hiking back to the south, and it was pretty uneventful at that point. And I remember we got to the mouth of Carbon, and we went. I think there was a riffle there. I can't recall exactly, but we put in below that
Yeah.
and went down and just floated, I guess, down to Lava Canyon Rapids
Yeah,
probably.
yeah.
And yeah, I just had a great time there, just floating in the river and chatting and in our little tiny dinghies, and then at that point we decided to split up because Bruce had to get back to town. And I wanted to spend some more time in the canyon, so I think we camped at Lava Canyon, and then the next day he took off heading for the Tanner, and I went up the Beamer Trail to check out the junction of the Little Colorado. I'd never been in that area before, so that was fun to go check that out, and then I spent some time trying to go up Palisades Creek, which is just well, it's pretty much where I was camping there, and I got pretty high up in that, but couldn't quite get through. So then on the way back, I also tried Comanche Creek and tried to go up that, and I didn't know at that point that Ken Walters and Harvey Butchard had found a route down from the East Rim by Comanche Point. And I was just down looking at it from below, looking up with my binoculars, thinking there's no way that anybody could climb up that it looked like it was just cemented quaternary boulder deposits, right? A fall, and of course I was seeing it from a distance, so it was foreshortened, but that's indeed the way the route that Ken Walters pioneered down. I think Harvey followed him down. I'm not sure about
Yeah, I
that.
think
Maybe
they
Harvey's.
both get credit for that
Yeah,
route for them.
yeah.
So,
So
yeah.
I looked at, I scoped that out and thought, well, that's there's nothing there. So yeah, and then just headed back, and so I was one interesting thing that I got to tell you. I camped my last night. It's wintertime, right? It's cold, and we're kind of on the residual of this storm that had passed through, and it was really cold. And I camped at Tanner. It was probably like close to freezing, and I camped at the rapids there. And I had my A-frame up, and I had there's boulders and whatnot, and I had some nice sand between the boulders. And I'm sitting there in my bag at night, just reading something, and I hear, and I get my turn my flashlight around, my Mallory flashlight, and there's a Siamese cat there, a
Whoa.
Siamese cat at the mouth of at Tanner Rapids,
Wow.
in the middle of January. How that cat got there, I have no idea what it was doing there. But the only thing I thought was maybe it was on a river party
Did
that.
you like hear kitty kitty and it come over and like it'll start purring when you were petting it?
No, I didn't want to get. I mean, I didn't want to. I thought it might be rabbit or something like
Oh,
that, right? So I didn't want to take a chance on. But it came walking right past me, right next to into my camp
Think
area. It was
it was
obviously trying to be friendly.
feral eating mice and just living off the land?
I guess so. I guess so.
Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. But I've never seen anything like that since. So
That's amazing.
it was pretty surprising to run into that. And
I forgot to ask you, did you have permits for these for the coming off of Teal Point down to Ra and for this one with Bruce as you came came in from the south.
Permits? What's permits?
Ah, okay.
No, we did not have permits.
Did you know
We
you
did not
needed
have.
them?
Yeah, okay. I'll tell you my philosophy on that. My,
Oh,
you
hang
know,
on,
when I
hang
first,
on, hang on.
yeah.
So we've been at this a little over an hour, and maybe
Yeah.
this is a good time to wrap this
Okay.
up, and we'll pick it up with a discussion of permits next time.
Okay, that sounds good.
Okay. All
Yeah,
right.
I'm sure we've both got a lot we can say about permits, so.
Well, no, it'll be good. All right. Well, with that, then this will conclude part five of Grand Canyon Oral History with Jim Haggart. Today is Sunday, February 21, 2021. My name is Tom Martin. Jim, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Tom. What a pleasure.